Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Go Loud. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of Magnified with Matt Cooper, the podcast series where we have lengthy and intimate conversations with guests from entertainment, business, sports, politics, whatever, with support from Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of BEV electric vehicles, build your fleet to your expectations, and visit vwfs.ie/business. And remember that Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. It's a slightly different Magnified today because if you have listened before, you'll know that I interview all sorts of people. But today, I'm going to be interviewed. Now, you might be wondering, how the hell does that work? What is the reason behind this? But blame my producer, Ed Smith, who had the idea last week, because after we had recorded the interview with Conal Laverty, which I hope you enjoyed, and if you didn't enjoy it because you didn't hear it, go back and listen to it, please. We recorded for BBC Radio 4 an interview where I was the interviewee about the life of Tony O'Reilly, an obituary. By the way, guess what the programme name is for the obituary show on BBC Radio 4? It's The Last Word. Yes, how apt that was indeed. So anyway, Ed came up with the idea, having listened to me, why don't we get somebody to interview you on Magnified? So the idea I came up with was, yes, Anton Savage. Best person possible, brilliant stand-in on The Last Word for many years, now has his weekend show on News Talk. And indeed, when Tony O'Reilly died, he interviewed me on his News Talk weekend show. And I thought, no one better. So Anton, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, no pressure, Matt. No pressure. No pressure.
And it is now over to you.
Okay, well, let me, because you obviously can't do it, let me blow a small bit of sunshine in your direction in respect of why you
just
are...
Just ask me questions.
No, well, I think it's worth putting in context where you come from in respect of Tony O'Reilly, because apart from having been the business editor of his his newspaper in the form of the Irish Independent, award-winning business journalist, reported on many of the things around which controversy grew in respect of Tony O'Reilly, and then went on to write the book, The Maximalist, the Rise and Fall of Tony O'Reilly, which is 550 very detailed pages.
And you know, I cut 50,000 words out of the original.
Mother of divine. Now, on the topic of The Maximalist, let me start where you finished with it, if I might, because I was hugely taken by your last paragraph in the book. I was hugely taken by other paragraphs, but the last one particularly rings out.
You know what you've done, Anton? You actually just read the last couple of pages of the book, didn't you? Rather than reading the whole book.
But they were
I know you, Anton.
So where it finishes up is, he was spancelled by his own deepest weakness. Whatever he had, whether in reduced circumstances or at the best of times, and no matter at what age, it was never enough. He was dominated by a need, a drive, a greed, perhaps, that would not let him rest and be content with great achievement. The desire for more spurred him on continually, and he chased down all that was possible, every experience, every accolade, every scent. In that frenzy of seeking, he found that it was quite possible to want too much. Such were the consequences of those elements of his personality that made him the maximalist. Let's go back and begin to unpick some of that. We are talking about a man who in sporting terms was Brian O'Driscoll, who in business terms was Michael O'Leary, and who lost it all.
Okay, loads to unpack there, Anton. Thank you for that. The Maximalist, the title of the book, was actually a phrase that he used about himself in an interview. I think it was with Business Week around the turn of the century. And that's where I picked up on the phrase and thought that would actually make for a good title of the book. It wasn't a word I was particularly familiar with at the time. But if you read the book, I think it explains, you know, what he is and what he tried to be. And yes, he always wanted more. And I suppose he must have had a difficult last decade or so, because he was a man who was so used to being the centre of attention, to being the driving force in so many things, to be always pushing for more. He wasn't a man who I suspect had anticipated retirement, and certainly not the type of retirement which left him almost marginalised to a degree. I can only imagine that must have been difficult for him. And he hid from public view to an extent, because, and it's in, the story is in the book about how when Queen Elizabeth came to Dublin and to Ireland in 2011, in previous years, even a few years earlier, you would have expected O'Reilly to have been front and centre in the greeting and the rest of it. After all, she had knighted him, and the fact that he was known in some quarters as Sir Anthony O'Reilly didn't go down well with many people. But he wasn't. He literally, when Lady Chris, his wife, greeted her to the National Stud, where she was the chairwoman at the time, and oversaw the guided tour of Queen Elizabeth around the stud, O'Reilly stayed very much in the background, stayed out of all the photographs, and was also, there was a bus bringing people to and from, and he actually stayed on the bus for a good part of it. He just hid out of public view, and he disappeared to a large degree. He disappeared because he was humiliated, I think, by the fact that he couldn't repay all his debts and that he ended up in bankrupt.
That's one of the things. I think now, because it is the sort of the primacy or the recency effect, the most recent thing that we have seen about O'Reilly has been the collapse of the empire. It's worth, I think, taking a second just to remind ourselves of how significant the empire was and how successful he was. I mean, this was a man who was, he was at one point the highest paid chief executive on the planet.
Oh yeah, this is one of the most significant Irish people and powerful people in the 20th century Ireland. I mean, beyond, after Taoiseach and ministers for finance and things like that, and you know, maybe some religious leaders until the power of the Catholic Church declined, he was a major figure in 20th century Irish life. And you know, he embraced all of that. He loved it. His ego, I mean, he was a very egotistical, vain man, but he also had an enormous amount of abilities and successes of which to boast. Although it can be very difficult, perhaps, at times when you are so successful to retain an even keel. I know that in some of the brief appearances he made in recent years, because he sort of came a little bit back out of his shell in recent years. So, for example, in 2018, too late for the book, but I wrote about it for the Business Post last week, he attended a function in Old Belvedere Rugby Club, which was organised by his godson, James McCarthy, whose father, Jim McCarthy, would have been his best man, and in a twist, would also have been his father, Jack's best man, when he married O'Reilly's mother, Aileen. Let me get back to that story in just a little while. But James McCarthy told me, because he lives near me and I met him in the street afterwards, and he told me about it, that he persuaded O'Reilly in the year that he was president of Old Belvedere to go to a lunch they were hosting before a match in Lansdowne Road with Leinster. And O'Reilly was reluctant and he didn't want to go there, and he had to be sort of persuaded to do so. And he was very slow at the first, fearing as much pity, I think, from people for his circumstances as anything else, but ended up by the end of the day loving it, apparently, swapping stories, doing his impressions. And then again, he gave one or two brief interviews to people in which he said, you know, the old line from, you know, that in life you have to realise that you also have to lose as well as to win, that he had learned that from rugby and the rest of it. And he became a little bit more, I think, understanding of his situation and came to terms with it. But although for a number of years, he found it exceptionally difficult. But what he also liked was, well, liked maybe is too strong a word, but he appreciated that at the time of his bankruptcy, a lot of people got in contact with him, even people who may not necessarily have particularly liked him, to express their dismay with the way he'd been treated by AIB, which had forced him into a situation. They were about to bankrupt him in Ireland. So he went to the Bahamas and got it done there ahead of them.
You mentioned in passing the story of sharing a best man with his father and the relationship with the family. It's an easy assumption to figure that he had the silver spoon, that he had the Belvedere education, that he came from wealthy background. If he had a silver spoon, it was tarnished.
Yeah, I mean, I think his family background is absolutely fascinating. I mean, it may not necessarily be particularly unusual now in 21st century Ireland, but it was extraordinarily different. He was born in 1936. He was born to his parents, Jack O'Reilly and Aileen, who, as it turns out, was not married to Jack and had changed her name by deed poll to O'Reilly when they sent their son to Belvedere.
In the 1930s?
Yeah. And you got to remember as well in those days that not only do we have no divorce, but children who were born outside of marriage were considered illegitimate. They were bastards, right? And O'Reilly blissfully went through his first 14 or 15 years without knowing any of this history that his family. So his father was a senior person in the Revenue Commissioners, and they lived in a house on Griffith Avenue. So they lived in reasonable comfort, but it wasn't extreme comfort. And the part of the reason for that was his dad was trying to get money from other things to try and feed a family of wife and four children who he'd left back in Wicklow, who he had abandoned effectively for O'Reilly's mother.
And who O'Reilly knew nothing about until his teens.
He knew nothing about it until he was either 14 or 15 and a priest in Belvedere decided to fill him in and tell him about this. Sat him down and had a conversation. Let me tell you, because I don't think you know about the circumstances of your family. And O'Reilly apparently cycled home, was going to go in and confront his parents and decided not to do so. And he did not discuss it with his parents, who didn't tell him until he was in his mid-30s, by which stage he already had a number of his children, was married to Susan. And Susan was starting to get suspicious because of things like, this was his first wife, at a couple of functions, one in particular, somebody had come up and said, oh, I know Tony's brother and sisters. To which she said, oh, you're mistaken, Tony has no brothers and sisters. So she said it to him, and O'Reilly got a bit shifty and said, oh, don't worry, people are always telling stories, making up stories about me. And she was felt, this is a bit odd. And then not long afterwards, he actually came clean and told her, well, actually, I believe this to be the case, and I think I have, yes, my father has another family who I've never met. And it was only that stage that he actually went and confronted his parents and got to know his siblings, at this stage, who were actually distributed around the world. And then, given that he knew, Jack decided that he wanted to marry Aileen to regularise things, even though he was now into his 70s. And he sought a divorce of his wife, which there was no divorce in Ireland. So he tried to get it done in the Bahamas, as a lot of Irish people managed wealth at the time to do. And he... I know this is a story which is quite extraordinary. He finally persuaded her to do the divorce, and then she died suddenly before the divorce could go through. So Jack was then free to marry Aileen, and he married her about 2 years before he died. But here's the thing. He married her without telling Tony that they were getting married. And he organised for James McCarthy, Tony's best man at his wedding a few years earlier to Susan, to be his best man when he married Aileen. And the story goes that O'Reilly was back in Dublin the weekend of the wedding, not knowing the wedding was going on. He rang a club in Stephen's Green where he used to go for dinner to book a table. And the manager, oh, that's great, you're coming for your father's wedding party. Oh, we're putting on this wonderful spread. And to which O'Reilly said, oh, no, actually, no, that's not it. And then apparently he and Susan went elsewhere instead.
Okay, now the coincidence at the end of that is funny. The actual totality of the story is horrifying. If we transpose that from 1930s, 1940s to today, if you said a young man went through his entire life to be told by a third party in his teens that he had an entire stepfamily he was unaware of, you'd say, well, that has to have lasting and permanent psychological damage.
Well, yeah, and that is the point. And in fairness, this was covered in Ivan Fallon's biography of Tony O'Reilly, which was published in the early 1990s, called The Player. The reason I went and did The Maximalist is I thought that there was an enormous life of Tony O'Reilly beyond the publication of that book. So, you know, I would have lent on that and various other things that I was able to find for the early part of O'Reilly's life. But certainly I was very much in a position from 1990 in particular, I was there, ringside seat, to take that life on myself. So, you know, I would have relied on that, those books and other things from the period. But there was an enormous degree of sensitivity when that biography emerged, because O'Reilly was quite anxious, apparently, about allowing this story to get into Ivan Fallon's book and to become public knowledge. And one of the things that Susan said for it at the time was that she believed that that was probably the driving force in his life, this need to prove himself and this need to be accepted. I think the need to be accepted was an enormous thing as well. I think, you know, there would have been people who were involved in the rugby tourism with the British and Irish Lions who felt like he was, apparently, even though he was 19 on his first tour to New Zealand, 23 in his second tour to South Africa, he was apparently the big charismatic figure, even amongst the older men on the tours, this driving force as well. But he was always going up meeting people and he was an extraordinary character. He needed this thing. He needed approval, and he also seemed to be quite sensitive to the whole thing with the British. And this is where I just want to come to this, because I mentioned the Queen Elizabeth story, the Sir Anthony O'Reilly thing. I mean, I remember there was when it was announced that this was happening, I was editor of the Sunday Tribune. You mentioned how I'd been business editor of the Irish Independent, but in 1996 I was parachuted into the job as editor of the Sunday Tribune. And I spent six and a bit very, very happy years there before I decided to quit to come here to Today FM. But O'Reilly, in about 2000, became Sir Anthony O'Reilly, to consternation, I mean, lost a lot of people. And there was an incredible story, which I detail in the book as well, about
of a special cabinet meeting.
A special cabinet meeting, because Bertie Ahern did not want to do it, to give him the permission. Technically, because he had been born before the establishment of the Republic in 1949, he was entitled to maintain dual British and Irish citizenship, but he was afraid of losing Irish citizenship if he did this. Now, I don't think actually they could have taken his Irish citizenship off him, but Conrad Black had lost his Canadian citizenship 2 years earlier when he had accepted a peerage in the UK, and he didn't want something like that to happen to him, but he desperately craved the title. So it left him somewhat beholden, I think, to Bertie Ahern afterwards. You know, when you get a favour like that done, and it could very much explain the extraordinary lengths to which some of the independent titles went to supporting Bertie Ahern in 2007, even though he was covered in scandal at that stage going into the election. But actually, funny thing in relation to O'Reilly and his need to be appreciated and approved. But after he became Sir Anthony, I met him at a function. I actually always remember what it was, because it was just after he had been knighted. It was out at Gavin's house. They used to have these management meetings for all the heads of all of the newspapers, and I would get brought along.
Titled after the houses, weren't they? You went to the Castlemartin meeting, or you went to the Fitzwilliam meeting.
Yeah, whatever. This was out in Bartra, out in Gavin's house, out in Dalkey. And I came in and I met O'Reilly, and he shakes hands and I said, "Hello, Tony." And he said, "I knew you'd be one person who wouldn't be calling me Sir Anthony." And I just looked at him, I said, "Yeah." And he said something questionable. He said, "Yeah, that's fine. I guess that's not a problem." He says, "Just do me one favour, because I know you won't be referring to me as Sir Anthony in the Tribune." And I had never used the Dr. AJF before that. I used to always call him Tony O'Reilly. Even in the Irish Independent, all the other pages would have Dr. AJF and I would write Tony O'Reilly. He said, "Just please call Chris Lady Chris as a courtesy to her." And I said, "Okay, that's fine." So in the Tribune then, it would have been Tony O'Reilly and Lady Chris O'Reilly.
Well, that's very funny, because I was a very junior writer in the Indo in overlapping a period when he still owned it. And I remember submitting copy once that had the referred to him as Tony O'Reilly, because that's all I ever knew. And when I read it in the paper that weekend, it had transposed into being
Sir Anthony O'Reilly.
For Sir Anthony. Now, you talked about his need to prove himself and his need to fit in. You would argue that at the point of which you are literally a star of Brian O'Driscoll standards, you are on Lions tours at a point when Irish rugby was not what it is now. And you are you have headed up a number of state entities very successfully, and you're heading for Heinz to run one of the largest commercial operations in food in the world. Is that not enough?
Well, actually, can I just come back? Because, you know, he could have taken a different career path. He qualified as a solicitor. And the one thing I saw is that maybe hasn't been emphasised enough is that he had an enormous brain. He had an enormous recall, attention to detail. He could remember everybody's name. He could remember documents he'd read. He could remember what you'd written. It was quite extraordinary, the size of his ability to absorb information, but not just absorb information, to actually understand it and actually apply it. And he was, and he also, he was in some respects quite intellectual. There would be other business people who would have a lot of the ability in relation to reading balance sheets and cash flow statements and all of those things, but they would be sort of quite limited and narrow in their thinking or in their interests, whereas he actually was, he was a man of great depth and he was a man of great width. So give him his absolute credit for those things as well. And funny, when he was on those rugby tours, himself and another guy who's also dead now, Andy Mulligan, they set up a double act where they literally would have been, O'Reilly would have been on the piano and they'd have been singing and they were doing impressions, and they actually ended up on radio in New Zealand, and it gave him the idea, should he go to radio in Ireland, right? And Gabe Byrne, after I published The Maximalist, I ran into Gabe Byrne at an event ceremony, and Gabe called me over and he said, complimented the book and the rest, which was very nice of him. And then he said, you know, he said, I love a little story, I'd love to have given you, he said, but he'd actually thought of going into radio when he came back from one of the rugby tours. I said, how'd you know that? He said, because we were inside in the GPO arcade, which is where I think the old 2RN was before Radio 1. And we used to have a lot of sponsored programs in those days. And I was doing one, Gay says, and Terry Wogan was doing one. And we saw O'Reilly inside in the studio recording a demo for one. And he said that myself and Wogan looking at each other and go, Jesus Christ, did that guy get on the radio? We're done for. He's way better than we are. But he didn't actually go there. So he wanted the route for money. He was interested in money. So he went to a job in Leicester for a while. Then he came back to Sutton's in Cork, where he dealt with farmers selling agricultural supplies, a part-time lecturer in UCC for the few extra quid. Then he got the job via the Sutton's people, farmers that he met, the head of Ballyclough co-op pushed him for the job ahead of Bourbonia. So in his mid-20s, he was running a Bourbonia. He came up with the Kerrygold brand for selling butter as a branded product rather than commodity. And that was a genuine innovation. It made up for about 10% of Ireland's exports within a couple of years. That much.
Kerrygold, one branded product.
One branded product. 10% of all of Ireland's exports. Then Jack Lynch as Taoiseach decided they had to save Irish sugar from collapse after very bad management. He was put into that. The Irish sugar problem had been exacerbated by losses at a subsidiary, Aaron Foods, and to bail out Aaron Foods, he did a joint venture deal with Heinz. And when Heinz saw him, they decided to take him out of Ireland, first to the UK for a couple of years, and then to the US. I mean, he was a man who, if he was struck by a lot of very bad luck at the end of his career, partly down to bad judgment, but also bad luck in the way the economy moved. He was a man who on a number of occasions benefited from some extraordinary good luck and then had the capacity and the talent to exploit that.
But the way you describe that, that's Midas touch. I mean, that is a period from school to his mid-30s where everything he interacts with comes out gold.
Except it didn't. And here's why, right? So he goes to Heinz, and this is to the point, and I am coming to the question you asked me. Like, he became this high-paid executive at Heinz. Even before he became chief executive, in the early to mid-70s, he was earning $350,000 a year. And that wasn't covering the interest payments of the debts he had for purchases of assets he'd made in Ireland. So this is the extraordinary thing that Heinz allowed him.
Hang on a minute. I just want to wrap my head around the mouth. 300 grand in the mid-70s.
350,000.
In the mid-70s.
In the mid-70s.
And it didn't cover the interest payments on the debts he'd already accrued.
Yes. So what happened was, right, he basically got a deal with Heinz. If I'm joining you, I want to be able to retain my existing Irish investments. They won't be management, he said. I'll just be an investor. He said he did get very involved in the management. So he bought loads of things. He wanted to form an industrial holdings group. First, it was called Fitzwilliam, but then he did a deal by which he bought Goulding's Fertilizer Company, the biggest fertilizer manufacturer in the country at the time. And because of the structure of the deal, his company became Fitzwilton. Then the oil crisis struck in 1973. The price of phosphate, which is the main ingredient in fertilizer, went up fivefold. They couldn't sell at a higher price. Suddenly they were losing money hand over fist. The banks started calling in loans because his interest bill was so big. As interest rates shot up, he couldn't meet his debts. And suddenly, so he was flying over and back from the United States to Ireland every weekend. He would fly, he would go down from Pittsburgh, which is where Heinz was headquartered, to New York, get on a flight to Dublin on a Friday evening, go over and be back at his desk in Pittsburgh on Monday morning, as if he hadn't been away for the weekend. He would do that about 40 weekends in the year.
How did the Heinz board and Heinz stock and shareholders feel about this?
They were happy enough because all the way through the 70s, he was in charge of all operations as chief operations officer. Profits were increasing and he worked his way up to be chief executive chairman and president, to have control effectively of the company. All sorts of things. This is the dichotomy of the man. In his Irish investments, he was actually, in some respects, a gambler. But when it came to running Heinz, he was a highly effective cost manager. It was like two different people. I'll give you an example of things that he did. To save money at the time, he had an idea that a Heinz ketchup bottle or mayonnaise or pickles or all of those things used to have labels on both sides of the bottle. So he took the labels off the back of the bottles and he saved up to $4 million a year. Okay. He also did innovate in things like, would you believe that he was the man responsible for getting, well, I'm sure there were other people involved in it and he took all the credit. But under his leadership, Heinz were the ones who introduced squeezy bottles for your ketchup and your mayonnaise. They were 18 months ahead of any of the opposition because they managed to work out the technology to replace the glass bottle with the squeezy plastic bottle.
This is the funniest thing. I had no idea he was involved. I had only recently read an analysis of why the squeezy bottle was so important. And apparently, according to the analyst that I read, if you have a glass bottle, the adult has to supply the ketchup because it takes effort and strength to shake the bottle. If you have a squeezy bottle, the child can do it. And if a child is in charge of ketchup deployment, four times as much ketchup gets deployed. Genius. But that was O'Reilly who came up with that.
Yeah.
So explain then, we have this huge level of success in the US. We have the point at which you could effectively hang it all up and say, I have done.
Anyone would have been happy with this. He was living in this place, Fox Chapel in Pittsburgh, in this beautiful house, 13-roomed house. Not as big as his other mansions back in Ireland, but a beautiful house by all accounts. I was never in it. They had a garden the size that they could play American football matches in it, which he used to organise on those weekends. He was in America. He would organise things with all the company executives and stuff like that, but he was never there. And that's one of the things, actually, somebody said to me last week, somebody who remembered reading the book or somebody who just read it recently, about all of the, he gave an interview to Ivor Kenny, the late Ivor Kenny, in which he admitted that he had all these places where he could sort of lay his head, but he never stayed long there, so nowhere was really home. Now, I think Castle Martin was home in County Kildare. I think that's why he suffered. I think that was traumatic for himself and Chris when they lost that as part of trying to settle their debts and had to sell it to John Malone. They bought another house nearby. In fact, he lived his last few years in Ireland, which came as a surprise to me because I thought he would sort of reject Ireland after what had happened. But he was very much of Ireland, despite the fact that all his children had emigrated and everything. But you would think that it would have been enough. But instead, he was determined to be, in many respects, not just the biggest business figure from Ireland internationally, as he was at the time in Heinz. And he was a trailblazer and been a first-generation Irish person educated in Ireland who got to the top of a major American company. But he also had to have all these things at home. So he had to have independent news and media, which he controlled with 27% of the shares. He had to control Waterford Crystal and Waterford Wedgwood. Also things like, let's not forget, Atlantic Resources. He wanted to be the man to find oil for Ireland.
Now, go back for a bit, because Castle Martin, I want to just talk briefly about. You have the privilege. I never have the privilege, but I was somebody who was there told me that before or after dinner, a servant, somebody, I don't know, would emerge and say, would the guests like to see Sir Anthony's art and do a tour of the house? Was it that spectacular?
Yeah. The very first time we went down, Aileen and myself, would have been March 1993. And I was very sort of surprised. I was only working as business editor in the Irish Independent a couple of months at this stage. So very surprised to get this request down. Like, I'm sort of like, what the hell do you wear? What do you do? And stuff like this is far from that was I born, Anton, right?
Breaking out the tails and the top hat territory, was it?
Not quite. But, you know, it was a lounge suit and whatever and stuff. And geez, Aileen, you better get a dress and stuff. And we were driving, Aileen was driving a Toyota Starlet. I always remember just on the offset this, the Toyota Starlet was not really sort of running very well and needed jump starting every now and again. And as we were leaving, it was a very cold night and the car wouldn't bloody start. And then I started pushing it out of the driveway. And I'm sort of going, and the driveway went for about 2 miles up to the gates, right? And I jumped it. I'm trying to push the thing and going, I can't go back in for help. And the next thing, the engine turned over and it started going. And I remember jumping in and saying, keep driving all the way back to Dublin. Don't stop for anything like that stuff, right? So anyway, and another time, actually, the next time we were down there, actually, as well, it was actually in the summer, so it was bright daylight when we arrived down for dinner. And I said, this was a much bigger one. There was a full marquee, and as it turned out, it was about 400 people for dinner, right? Whereas the first night we were there, it was a smaller, I think it was only about 60 or 70 people, including Paul Newman was there at that time.
Of course he
exactly,
was.
Right? Oh yeah, you know, I could do world-class name dropping of all the people who used to turn up at O'Reilly's gigs. But the second time we were driving in down through the long, through the rolling paddocks with the horses and all that, and you see, here's us in the little Toyota Starlet, silver Toyota Starlet that Aileen's driving, and all of the BMWs and works ahead of us, and we're going, oh, okay. And the car was like a tip. And I'll say this, I hope Aileen listens to this. I mean, she used to keep it, still does, like an absolute tip. There were all sorts of cans of Coke and McDonald's stuff thrown all over it and stuff like that. And I always remember the next thing she looks and she goes, oh, fuck, it's valet parking.
But the thing with Casimir,
you asked me. We the tour. He did give us the tour. He personally gave us the tour of the art, and because we arrived too early, there was nobody else.
And the art is, we're talking Manet's and that kind of crack, aren't
we? He didn't have the Manet at that stage, right? It was a load of Jack B. Yeats. I think there was a Turner there.
A load of Jack B. Yeats.
A load of them, yeah.
Now this, and I want to come back to Waterford Wedgwood, to the independent news and media, to all of that. Before we do, this is one of the things that I've always wondered about. There's no nice way to put it. The flashness of Tony Riley. He was not the Chuck Feeney silently, quietly, anonymously going through life as a billionaire. He wanted everybody to know. He had the Bentley, he had Castle Martin, he had the best of everything, and showed it off to an extraordinary degree. Why?
I think that might go back to the thing about needing to prove himself. It goes back to his heritage, the shock that he got when he was a 14-year-old.
It is, look at who I am and what I have achieved,
yeah,
and what I've accumulated.
I think there was a certain element to that, and that's why he kept striving for more and more and more all the time. You know, and yet, I mean, in many respects, he shared it, and he was generous as well. Like, you know,
but he did want you to know he had it.
He did.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Independent news and media then, because that in the first half of his life, the kind of associations with Hines and with the sporting success in rugby, the second half of his life, hugely he was associated with being a media mogul.
Yeah.
He was our Citizen Kane. Why, first of all, did he want to get involved in media? Is this just more capacity to control his own image and brand?
I think there was a story, but he actually, I have to say, he genuinely loved newspapers and he really enjoyed the company of journalists. He was very unusual in business figures like that. And I have to say, there were a number of occasions where I very much appreciated that he didn't interfere. Now, you know, the skeptics and cynics would say, well, he didn't have to interfere because he appointed people who would make sure that they wouldn't do what he would. But actually, there were occasions when I was really glad of the fact that I felt that I could do what I needed to do. I can have a number of examples for you. One, when I was in the Irish Independent and I got a story that the Indo had bought shares in the Irish Press, which was actually true, that they were in doing a due diligence and that they were about to buy a quarter of the shares in the Irish Press. And I got the story and I went down to Vinnie Doyle and said, listen, I'm chasing this down, I believe. And Vinnie sort of looked at me and went, oh, Christ. Right, well, go after it, see what you can get. And I went after it and I got the story and we broke the story that the Independent had become a shareholder in the Irish Press. Now, people thought that it had been planted with me. It wasn't. I mean, like, it came through all the sources by people who were actually quite appalled by the idea. And about few months later, O'Reilly was talking to me at an event or something and he says, geez, he said, you caused me fierce grief that time when you broke that story about the investment in the press. He said, Bernard Summers got on to me and said, you got to kill the story. This could kill the deal. You got to stop it coming out. And he said, I had to turn around to Bernard and say, no, I can't do that. He said, if Matt Cooper has the story, he has the story and it's not for me to interfere to stop one way or the other. I'm hands off in relation to this. This is a thing. And I actually very much appreciated that. And then there was another one. And this maybe goes to the point where I said that people would have done things that they anticipated what he would have wanted. But back in about 2001, when he was trying to buy Aircom, and I wrote an editorial in the Tribune saying that...
which was then owned by Independent,
News and Media. So I would report it into him and Liam Healy and others and whatever. And at the time, there was a bidding battle between himself and Dennis O'Brien. And Dermot Desmond, I think, was involved as well. Looked as if he could be a potential bidder. And I wrote an editorial saying shareholders should sell to none of them. That this wasn't in the national interest. And that this idea of it being taken over and stuff like that. And so the first edition hit the streets. And I get a phone call from somebody senior within Independent News and Media. Are you mad? Get that editorial out, replace it for the next edition and hopefully nobody will see it. And I said, no, I'm not. I said, that's staying in. And they said, you're absolutely crazy. You're committing career suicide by doing this and stuff. And I sort of took a deep breath and said, no, OK, I'm sticking to my guns on this. I can't. I'd lose face internally if I was to remove it, whatever and stuff. And I believe it, so it's staying in. And the thing is, a few weeks later, somebody involved in one of the bidding groups told me that at a Monday morning meeting after the editorial appeared on Sunday, Monday morning meeting of the Aircom group, and one of the advisors brought up, what the hell is this? Like, you know, what action are you taking? And O'Reilly apparently defended me and said, hang on. And he actually said, you know what? This is proof that I'm not an interventionist. And he said, people are worried about I'd be interventionist in Aircom. Well, here's one of the newspapers that we control, and the editor has just told people not to sell the shares to me.
Two things to devil's advocate that. One, the family of Joseph McAnthony, following the death of Tony O'Reilly, very passionately, publicly maintained that Joseph McAnthony was effectively frozen out of Irish journalism and ended up having to go to Canada because O'Reilly's purchase of Independent, control of Independent, overlapped at the point where he was doing fabulous investigative reporting into the hospital sweepstakes and the reporting that he did, particularly in respect of Ray Burke, who was then close to O'Reilly, that O'Reilly, without doing anything overt, sent him to Coventry. That and the famous It's Payback Time. How do you square the two of those with non-intervention?
Well, I'll tell you another one. And I don't know if I put this in the book, so it may not, but when I took over as editor of the Tribune, somebody else, again, quite clearly on his behalf, told me to get rid of three named individuals from the Tribune that O'Reilly didn't like. And I was in the job less than a week, and I took a deep breath and I said no. And one of them, because I told him this recently, we were laughing about it, I have told him the thing. One of them was Frank Fitzgibbon, who was writing a column at the time. And I had literally, an hour after I put my foot in, said, no, Frank rings me and he quits because he was going to the Sunday Times. And I couldn't tell him at the time. I remember going, you fucker, I have just literally laid it out for you and you've now just rang me up and tell me you're quitting your column. And so I went to work for him actually years later as a columnist in the Sunday Times and I told him this. And I reminded of him recently, we were having coffee recently and I reminded
him. I'd remind him on a weekly basis.
Yeah, yeah. The other one was... Des Crowley, and I kept Des for as long as I could. We kept him for many, but then he did go on a redundancy round a few years later, and himself and Des Crowley would have been at loggerheads over the years. And the other one who I managed to keep all the way to the very end was Eamon McCann. And I said, I'm not getting rid of Eamon McCann. And so it was sort of, I said it was a black mark put against me for being an impudent pup, but I reckon at that stage I was only in the job a week or so that I had some flexibility at that stage. The payback time editorial thing was very interesting as well.
Can you just do a quick reminder of it for people?
Okay, on the Wednesday, was it a day before the election or 2 days before the election? Front page editorial, which in itself was very unusual. For years we have been bled white, it's payback time. And that happened in an environment whereby O'Reilly was at war with the Rainbow government in relation to a television distribution system called MMDS, Multiple Micropoint Microwave Distribution Service. Basically, it was a time when lots of Ireland couldn't get anything beyond RT1 and RT2 off the aerial on the roof. And Ray Burke had actually encouraged the Indo to take up the licences, and the Indo had got investment from overseas American interests and it put quite a bit of money into it. But what happened was a lot of people were putting up illegal deflectors all around the country and then giving free services, TV services, Donegal and West Cork and places like this. And nobody was bothering buying the independent MMDS service. And it was losing money hand over fist. And not unreasonably, O'Reilly wanted the government to shut down all of these illegal deflectors. Not unreasonably, the government said, you can shag off because we lose countless votes if we actually do so. And indeed, I think there were even candidates in a previous election had very much fought on the basis independence fighting for illegal TV signals in a great show of national independence. Give us our BBC and our ITV. So O'Reilly was at war with this and... he had a really, I mean, this is another thing. I mean, Ivan Yates and myself discussed this on the Path to Power podcast as well, because Ivan was called down to Castle Martin in relation to his role as Minister for Agriculture about grants for a Heinz factory in Dundalk. But while there, heard chapter and verse for O'Reilly's displeasure about a Richard Bruton mandated Competition Authority report into the newspaper business during the time of that government, because it was a block on the independent effectively taking control of the Irish Press Group, which went closed as a result. So he would have had a lot of beef. And then John Bruton went to his holiday home in Glendore. And this is something I've actually wrote about as well, the idea that ministers and the Taoiseach, instead of O'Reilly going visiting them in government base, I just thought, like, lads, you're fucking stupid to be doing that.
I mean, whatever about being summoned to your main home, being summoned to your holiday home.
Well, I think in fairness to John Bruton, I think he may have been in West Cork at the time.
But it's extraordinary. Imagine it happening today.
Oh, geez. I mean, even to have happened then was ridiculous. But if it had been disclosed publicly at the time, it was only subsequently in the tribunals that it came out. So, it was an exercise of power. I mean, Vinnie Doyle, the late Vinnie Doyle, who have been my mentor, and I still have the height of respect for Vinnie, would have been the guy who, despite O'Reilly not wanting me actually originally, brought me in as business editor of the Irish Independent, spent 6 months trying to get me in and got me in, and then had to fight O'Reilly off on it. And Vinnie was the guy who, when I was made editor of the Sunday Tribune, the night before I got the phone call to tell me I was appointed, Vinnie brought me to the pub down, what's the name of the pub down off O'Connell Street? But anyway, the Confession Box, I think it was, and brought me in there and said, after about 4 pints, says, right, the reason we're out having a few pints is tomorrow morning you're getting a phone call to tell you you've been made editor of the Tribune and you're taking the job. Vinnie, I've been the height of fondness for and respect for and the rest of it. And Vinny always swore it was his decision and the rest of it, but it was just one of those happy coincidences, perhaps, that it just happened to chime with O'Reilly's distaste for the outgoing government.
You hit on a key word in the middle of all that, which is tribunals.
Yeah.
Now, I always loved the fact that, for those who haven't had the joy of reading the entire Moriarty Tribunal report, even the prologue is good because it begins with a credit to you and the role that your reporting played in the fact that tribunal exists.
Yeah, right. That didn't necessarily do me any good in here, but anyway.
Yeah, I can imagine it made for an interesting period. Now,
you better explain that in a minute.
Well, you explain the whole thing because this is an area of such complexity that only somebody as immersed in it as you would be able to explain. We end up in a situation where we have the old bull and the young bull of Irish billionaires, effectively in a Pyrrhic battle, death spiral over control of independent news and media. And we have the massive upheaval of the tribunal analysis of a phone license that both of them went for and that had such massive sequelae across Irish political life thereafter. And in the middle of it is Matt.
So we'll go back to 2001. I'm the editor of the Tribune and I get a story, I get a tip off that Dennis O'Brien had paid 50 grand to Fine Gael in the run-up to the, or was it the run-up, or was it 6 weeks after the awarding of the licence for the second mobile phone. Dennis O'Brien won the competition. ESAT Digifone won the right for what was then, we didn't know how valuable it would be, it turned out to be very valuable, the right to compete with Aircel, I think that was the telecom Aaron company, which had the only mobile phone licence. So this was to introduce competition. O'Reilly was defeated candidate. He had been in a bid for it as well. Michael Lowry was in charge of the process. And I discovered that there had been 50 grand had been paid via Telenor, who was O'Brien's partner in the consortium, had at O'Brien's behest made a payment of 50 grand. I chased down the story over a number of weeks. I nailed it and ran it. And there was absolute consternation, as you can imagine. Dennis O'Brien immediately out screaming, this is dreadful, blah, blah, and the rest of it and stuff. I will say one bit. I mean, I did get a phone call. And I don't think, no, I didn't, definitely didn't put this in the book. But Gavin O'Reilly rang me and he goes, are you absolutely, this is the most, I said, I don't want to be ringing you. I shouldn't be ringing you. I said, but I've got to know, do you have this right? Because if you don't have this right, and I said, I have it right, it's correct. And a couple of hours later, Telenor issued a statement to say, yes, this is what actually happened. And I was bang in the clear and suddenly the story was flying. But it wasn't, you know, the story was, it created panic. They had no idea that of this. And they had no idea that I was going to break the story, and I broke it. So that brought Dennis O'Brien into the tribunal, and it led to all sorts of stuff going on. And it led to a belief, I think, in Dennis O'Brien's behalf, allied to the fact that he was bitter at having lost out to O'Reilly, who was part of the consortium that bought Aircom, and against O'Brien, a lot of which I detail in the book as well. And so, yeah, there would have been an enormous amount of bitterness there. And then, sort of to my surprise, I left the Tribune to come to Today FM to work on The Last Word because I got the opportunity and I was having some difficulties with them in relation to printing arrangements. I wanted to do a deal to get much better quality printing of the Tribune, which they didn't want to do because they wanted to keep the printing in-house and the Independent. So there had been a number of disagreements. I was told to cop myself on and I said, well, you know what? I'm going off to work in radio. And as it just then happened, Today FM many years later, a few years later, was bought by one Dennis O'Brien, who I didn't have a close relationship, shall I say, during my time in Today
FM. I remember how relaxed and happy you seemed at the time. Go back then to how that ends up with the two of them in the power struggle over INM, because that has to be one of the most interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back. It started around 2006 and suddenly O'Brien started buying small chunks of shares and then kept growing it. And I think initially the Independent people, O'Reilly, didn't take it seriously. How the hell is he going to? And then over time, he built up a shareholding to be equal of O'Reilly's. And then it just happened at a time that suddenly the newspaper business went into steep decline. Circulation was starting to ebb away because of the internet. And also advertising revenue started draining away. And then when you had the property crash, all the property advertising evaporated. And this was central to two things in O'Reilly's life that went really badly wrong at that time. He was already having a financial crisis at Wedgwood, Waterford Wedgwood, and that was losing money. He was pouring money in. Himself and his brother-in-law, Chris's Chris's brother, Peter, put 540 million quid into Waterford Crystal. And they might as well have just thrown it into the furnace and burnt it for all the good that it did. And then Waterford Wedgwood collapsed. And O'Reilly was left basically into government. No, they weren't going to Castlemartin. He was visiting government buildings, begging effectively for help to try and keep Waterford Crystal going. And he kept throwing money in and it was all useless. At the same time, the value of independent newspapers was evaporating, but he had borrowings that he had taken against that. So somebody very, very close to him, while I was researching the book, swore blind to me that he had had an independent analysis done in 2008, just before everything started sliding away, which had said he was a bona fide, a genuine billionaire, that he had a billion more in assets than he had in debts.
Oh, he was a net billionaire. You sell everything, he walks away with a pile of a billion in cash.
Yeah. And suddenly that just all evaporated, and suddenly the asset contracted dramatically, all his assets. And his debt was there, but he added to the debt in his attempt to try and keep control of independent news media and to suddenly to buy more shares so he would have a bigger voice than Dennis O'Brien, who bought so many shares. As the shares were going up in value, despite the fact that the newspaper industry was contracting, he borrowed money. And that's what eventually did for him in the end.
And was that the O'Brien O'Reilly battle over independent news and media, shorn of all of the complexities of the corporate world and the finances, was it literally just a measuring contest?
No, I think it was a bit more than that, because I think at this stage O'Reilly believed it was his and that O'Brien was trying to take it off him, so he had to defend it. He was not going to have his pride and joy taken away from him by this upstart, as he saw O'Brien.
Even though it's a publicly listed company, yeah, I mean, he has control of it, but it's still publicly.
It was a publicly listed company, but it was his personal fiefdom to a large degree, which was a weakness of it. But anyway, and O'Brien was determined that he was getting control of it. It wasn't that O'Brien, I think, wanted particularly to be a media mogul. And, you know, for all of Dennis O'Brien's skills in relation to telecoms, you know, I don't think he actually was a particularly good media person, didn't really necessarily understand what was involved particularly well. And he himself lost, I think, at least 400 million as the shares of independent newspaper news media cratered. So, I mean, O'Brien has said this himself publicly, you know, that it was the worst investment he could have made and the rest of it. And it was for all the wrong reasons, I suspect, that he had actually done it.
We're on the cusp of the absolute collapse of everything that O'Reilly worked on. Before that, can I run something past you? I was talking to somebody who worked closely with O'Reilly for a number of years, and they said that people talk about his hubris, they talk about his success, they talk about his drive, they talk about his acquisitiveness. And for him, he said the defining characteristic of Tony O'Reilly was patriotism. Now, he's a friend of his, so he may be looking through rose-tinted glasses. But he said Waterford Wedgwood was a flawed business decision rooted fundamentally in patriotism.
Yeah.
Because he thought it was a great brand, an Irish brand that could do well. And he pointed at the Ireland funds and said, if you look at what he did in the Ireland funds, if anybody is to leave a legacy, what better legacy could you want? Is there anything in that?
Yes, I think there is, actually. But again, this is one of the absolute paradoxes of the man, that he was a proud Irishman and yet he went by the title in the last 20 years of his life as Sir Anthony O'Reilly. I mean, the paradox is just absolutely enormous. But yes, the Ireland funds, he was very much against the sort of the physical force tradition. Now, can I go back to his childhood again? And there's a figure from Republican history, Pater O'Donnell. He was O'Reilly's mentor, right? Now, this is utterly bizarre, right? We're talking about one of the heroes of the original IRA. And he basically was like a second father to O'Reilly growing up. So much so there were a group of boys used to go, O'Donnell used to bring them up to Donegal and the rest of it and fishing and learning Irish. And O'Reilly would said he would have taught them an enormous amount about history and about capitalism and Marxism and the rest of it. And his joke was in the end,
the latter bits didn't stick.
No, he said in the end, we were adherents to Marx, he said, Padder to Karl, me to Groucho. And even there was a special ceremony for Padder O'Donnell in his later years in the Abbey Theatre in the 1980s, at which two of the main speakers were Fintan O'Toole and Tony O'Reilly.
Explain then the Ireland funds, because the Ireland funds, as I understand,
I just say, but he would have been very much, he believed that his big issue in the United States in the 1970s was that he believed that NORAID was raising funds from the Irish American community to be put to wrong use back in Ireland. So what
to
he
fund
thought,
guns and terrorism, absolutely. Not putting too fine a point.
Yeah, absolutely. So his belief was he believed very much in peaceful outcome, peaceful solution, and he believed that what was required was to instead to tap up Irish America money for cross-border and cross-community projects, which is what the Ireland funds were. Now, they became an enormous success, raised an awful lot of money.
I mean, hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions and stuff. The critics, again, would say that, you know, this was a end to burnish his own ego and the rest of it. And there was a certain element of that as well. But there are also, I've become aware even in the last few days, I mean, one of the more interesting posts on Twitter after he died was the economist in ICTU, Laura Bambrick, put up a tweet about saying that she was one of the recipients of personal financing. She said she did her PhD in Oxford because O'Reilly financed it. And there were others like that he quietly, actually did quietly finance and help to actually go and do things and stuff like that.
There's a lot of what the Ireland funds funded that is still not known publicly.
Absolutely.
Because it's still very tender, but yeah. It did make a difference.
Yeah, it did. So yeah, he set that up with Dan Rooney, who later became the U.S. ambassador to Ireland, who became a friend in Pittsburgh because Dan Rooney owned the Pittsburgh Steelers, and of the two biggest things in Pittsburgh at the time were the Steelers and Heinz. And O'Reilly became a friend of Rooney's, and they set this thing up together. So yeah, but also, I mean, there's a photograph in the book as well, which I chose deliberately because it was from 2008, and it was an investment conference in Belfast, and O'Reilly was photographed with Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley together, the Chuckle Brothers. And there's O'Reilly smiling with them as well. And he was actually really praiseworthy of Martin McGuinness at the time. And I remember thinking at the time, even before I came to writing the book, my God, O'Reilly's gone on his own journey, just like Martin McGuinness has gone on his own journey, if he's standing up in an investment conference and praising Martin McGuinness.
Go back then to that period, 2006 through 2008. He is already stretched to breaking point trying to defend the acquisitiveness of...
Well, no, this was happening slowly. It didn't really until... I don't think until 2008 that he realised that he was running into trouble. Now, he had maybe a slight suspicion, as in that's why they got the audit done to see what was his true wealth in the event that he had to defend himself from an assault by Dennis O'Brien.
But
O'Brien,
also, he still thought he was relatively okay at that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. O'Brien at that stage was building slowly. And then the share prices started coming back, which should have been a sign to the boat, stop this. But they saw these as buying opportunities and they both started buying shares, trying to build up their positions.
So, like, you know that joke of how did you go bankrupt? Well, very slowly at first and then quite quickly.
Yeah, that's actually what happened.
How? What happened?
Well, the Waterford Crystal thing, Waterford Wedgwood, suddenly, bang, that was gone. So there was no asset value left. And he had burned cash reserves and borrowed money. So that was the major problem. Then independent news media suddenly is in crisis mode. They start having to get rid of, and this, I think, what would have hurt him as well. And this was again at the push of O'Brien to try and save the business from going under. They had to start selling things like New Zealand, South Africa, Australia. All of these businesses had to go, the independent in London. And there was a certain amount of these, again, were trophy assets for O'Reilly. All, if you may notice, English-speaking countries, but also countries where rugby is played. So he made use of all his connections to build up newspaper businesses in each of those countries. He also had ambitions which weren't realised. An initial investment had been made in India. I mean, basically, they bought half of one of the biggest Indian newspapers to come in there. That was in about 2005, and there would have been enormous. But again, going back to the whole thing of the jollies and stuff, as well as having a board, an enormous board in independent news media, which he stuffed with people like ex-politicians and stuff and the rest of it, and nearly all men. There was like very few women on his boards as well. He also had an international advisory board. So he would have people like Ben Bradley, the former editor of the Washington Post, on it, on the advisory board. As an aside, Ben sat beside me at a dinner in Castlemartin one night.
Oh, of course he did. Yeah. You, Paul Newman, and Ben.
I've got others for you, Anton.
Now, it's worth saying, by the way, before you continue, for those unfamiliar, Ben Bradley was the man that JFK used to go to yeah. keep sweet, effectively. He was yeah. that powerful that JFK yeah. had to doff the cap to him. Sorry. Absolutely. So you and Ben, side yeah. by side in Castlemartin.
And you know what Ben wanted to know? Ben was in his 70s at this stage. He wanted to go clubbing. He was bored. I sent Ben Bradley to Lily's.
Do you remember we talked about Tony O'Reilly peaking in high? You did nothing else the rest of your life. I sent Ben badly.
But sorry, the other person he had on the International Advisory Board, and this shows you how he loved collecting people around him, Sean Connery. Now, what does Sean Connery know about newspapers, right? So the entire International Advisory Board are brought to India on a jolly, it cost a fortune, right? And they went to visit the Taj Mahal, right? This is all in the book. And they went to visit the Taj Mahal, and as they're getting out of the bus, suddenly the crowd realised, it's James Bond. And they rushed the bus, and they all had to get back on the bus, and they couldn't visit the Taj Mahal. Oh, but look, hang on, the amount of people, I mean, like he, when Nelson Mandela had his first holiday after leaving Robben Island, he spent it at O'Reilly's house in the Bahamas, in Lyford Quay. O'Reilly said, you want the house? Yeah, you can have it. So then you see the photos of Mandela and O'Reilly. And then a couple of years later, the biggest newspaper group in South Africa comes up for sale, the Argus. He's negotiating the deal. They're wondering about government thing. O'Reilly said, hang on a second, I have to make a phone call. He went and he rang Mandela. Mandela says, come round to the house. O'Reilly comes back into the Argus. People says, I'll be back in a couple of hours and go round to Nelson Mandela's to get this sorted out. That was the way he mover and shaker, he operated. Henry Kissinger was a big mate of his. Actually, I ended up sitting beside Kissinger at lunch one day in his house. And actually, I know this is shameless name dropping stuff, isn't it? Sorry, Anton. And you know what the worst thing was? I ended up really liking Kissinger by the end of it. Beside myself, thinking of the dreadful things this man has done. And he was genuinely charismatic as well.
Did you send him clubbing?
No, he didn't look to go clubbing, no.
Talk to me then about the end of it all. And talk to me about AIB's role, because one of the things that was unusual in this is AIB finds itself effectively in state ownership and then totally in state ownership, which has to have influenced how it deals with Ireland's most famous billionaire.
Yeah, I suspect, like, O'Reilly had no friends in that government. Put it this way, Michael Noonan was a veteran of governments which had come into conflict with independent news and media.
He would remember payback time.
He remembered payback time. He would remember all the trouble back in the 80s as well when Atlantic Resources was looking for better terms and oil licenses and the rest of it. So I approached Michael Noonan when writing the book to ask him about it. And he, I asked him, did he have any sympathy for O'Reilly's position? And it was just a gruff no. So I don't think there was any government involvement in saying bankrupt. But I think people in AIB realised that there wouldn't be any political pushback for doing so.
Now, a lot of people that I've talked to see this as having been an egregious thing to do to him. Maybe I am naive. I'm still sketchy as to how AIB could have done a deal with somebody at a point at which when the IMF is walking into town, how could they be seen to do a deal?
Because it was a little bit later into 2014, 2015. And as Ivan Yates pointed out on the Path to Power podcast, AIB only bankrupted directly two people, Ivan Yates and Deirdre Yates. Right, everyone else sort of came into scheme of arrangements or things like that. And as it happened, AIB was one of a series of creditors that O'Reilly was doing a deal with to pay back as much as he possibly could. And he did pay back most of what he owed in situations as much as he could. And he sold everything. He really did. The Monet painting you mentioned earlier, which cost him 26 million quid, sold. Castle Martin sold. All of the other properties, all the things. He sold everything to pay back his debts as much as he could. And all the other creditors were willing to do a deal and AIB wouldn't do it. And that's why he went to the Bahamas and opted for bankruptcy there to effectively put in place the deal that AIB wouldn't agree to, but everybody else was happy with.
In terms of that bankruptcy, you mentioned the brother-in-law losing 500 million.
Between them, it was 544 million between the two of them.
It's easy to assume that that was all Tony O'Reilly's money. But in actual fact, the brother-in-law was hugely independently wealthy himself because Lady Chris was hugely independently wealthy. So if you are married to a billionaire, do you ever go bankrupt?
Well, that's a good point, but she wouldn't cover his debts. There were certain things. Lone Star did buy the Anglo debts that Peter and Galandris and Tony O'Reilly had, and I think Peter Galandris sorted out the Lone Star part of it and stuff like that. Yeah, the scepticism would have been that, yeah, that Tony O'Reilly married Chris for her money because she was wealthier than him. In fairness, I have to say, Chris was a very, very nice woman. And everybody would say that she looked after him tremendously in the last couple of decades of his life. He would have been lost without her. So the transaction, you know, if there was a financial incentive when he married her in the early 1990s, I mean, it seemed to be a genuine match. There was genuine love there.
But I more mean when you know, sorry, when people look at
I think people expect, I think AIB may have expected, sure, she's loaded, she'll pay off the debts. And I think there was a certain point where we said, well, no, actually, these debts are his, her money is hers, don't be expecting because they're married that she's going to pay off his.
But it does mean then, one assumes, that he didn't end up in a situation where in his latter years he was living on the clippings of tin.
No, absolutely not. So he continued, she owned the house in Deauville in France, which they would have used quite a bit. And actually, a story in relation to that is that when they were looking for a house in France and she wanted it in the area, Deauville, because of her horse breeding interests, O'Reilly looked for what house had the Nazi commanders used in the area in the Second World War. And it was an old castle that apparently went back to William the Conqueror's time. But the reasoning was that when the Nazis swept into France, they took all the best houses for the commandants and the rest of it for the area commanders who they put in place. So this was the best house in Deauville. So that's the one they went to buy.
So save yourself the time by letting the Nazis do the due diligence effectively.
Yeah. And that's the house he went and bought, right? Or she bought. So they used that to say, when they sold Castle Martin, they bought a smaller place not far from it, a smaller stud farm. So yeah, he didn't live in poverty in his final years.
A smaller stud farm.
Yeah. It was hers. So he lived there, you could say, by grace of heaven. But sadly, she died last year. Chris died at the age of 73. She was in France. She was at some horse racing event. And she had actually, I only discovered recently, she had overcome cancer. But she died suddenly of a heart attack. And I think a lot of people were very sorry for him as well, losing her, because his six children are still alive. I mean, they're into their late 50s now and 60s. They're sort of spread across the world, although they would have been coming to visit him a lot in Kildare in recent years when he was back too. But all of the people, and even when I wrote the book in 2015, an enormous amount of the people who had been really important to his life had all died. They'd all gone, because as a young man, he tended to hang around with older people and he went through his life with these older people, so they died before him. And there was hardly anybody close to him left. I mean, even close friends like Kevin McGoran would have died in the early part of COVID, would have been one of the last who would have been left, you know. And there were still people going and seeing him and the rest of it and stuff, and the younger generations, but and people who would have worked with him over the years. But most of the people to whom he had been closest to had died well over 10, 15 years ago.
Where we started was with how extraordinarily difficult it must be to be mid-teen before you discover the reality of your family and that you have an entire step-family that you're unaware of. Regardless of anybody's view of the positives or negatives of Tony O'Reilly, it must be a similarly uniquely difficult thing to have been Lions rugby star, to have been the highest paid and most influential Irish executive that there was, to have been Ireland's largest media mogul, to have been significant in the creation of the nascent peace process, to have been as significant in Irish life. And then to find yourself in a position where it is all gone and you're more or less on your own.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story. I mean, he was an extraordinary man who lived an extraordinary life, which made it an extraordinary story, which is why I had to write the book and which is why it's 550 pages and why loads of stuff didn't get into it as well. It is, I mean, you
but
could...
But how do you live
you
with couldn't, that? I mean, how do you live with knowing that you were of an age? Like, if that happened when you were 30, you could at least say, of time, I can try to rebuild. But if you're in your late 60s, early 70s, at the point of where it all...
And it could have happened, as I said, in the 1970s. And it's amazing that he allowed himself to get into that situation again, where it did happen to him. And this was, it must have been for many years a case of regret. But my God, what a life. I mean, you couldn't make a story like his up. I mean, he's actually ruined it for me to an extent in finding other subjects to write biographies about. I mean, no offence to Michael O'Leary, who I wrote a book about 3 years later, but Michael O'Leary is pretty boring by comparison. I mean, Michael O'Leary is a brilliant businessman who does colourful stunts and all the rest of it, but you know, he doesn't have the depth or the breadth that Tony O'Reilly had in his life. It's very hard to find stories of the type that made up The Maximalist. And
yeah, because effectively you're talking, you would need Michael O'Leary to have run maybe something like Delta as well while he was at it, and to have played for the Lions. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
If you're right. If you made it a fictional character, you'd say, no, it's too much. Nobody's going to buy it.
There's a book I loved, William Boyd, Any Human Heart, I think it was. And there's a couple of books that William Boyd wrote, which were sort of life stories of fictional characters going over up into their 80s and 90s. And they're brilliant books, but they're not the story like this Tony O'Reilly one was. I mean, you know... Yeah, and he was flawed. I mean, he was deeply flawed. But then again, who isn't? I mean, like, nobody's perfect. And nobody, you know, if you look to use the business term, a balance sheet of your assets and liabilities and the rest of it, he had his assets, he had his liabilities, the non-financial ones. But, you know, overall, you know, I think he told one of his sons when he was still in a position to do so, according to these funeral speeches, you know, that a year ago he'd lived a happy and full life. And he was aware of that. And yeah, he did.
There's a line that my dad used to have where he paraphrased in Greek tragedy, where he said that ultimately people's vices tend to be their greatest virtue taken to extremes. And the same is true of O'Reilly.
Explain that.
Well, I think if you look at what you've detailed with O'Reilly, what was his great virtue was drive, charm, charisma, networking, yeah. The next thing, the next purchase, the next acquisition. What ultimately tore him asunder was the next thing, yeah. The next acquisition, the next drive. So that which made him also destroyed him to some extent.
Icarus flying too close to the sun.
Matt, thank you very much for letting me...
No, Anton, thank you very much. Jesus, thank you very much. Which means I have to do the final read, which I do all the time. Thank you. That's it for today's Magnified with Matt Cooper. Hope you enjoyed it. We have lots of other interviews that I've conducted that you can go back to listen to. And you can recommend them, please, to a friend if you like listening to be on Apple, Spotify or the Go Loud app. So my thanks to Anton Savage for being so gracious as to come in and help me with this. Our thanks also to our sponsors, Volkswagen Financial Services, Business Lease and Volkswagen Financial Services, regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. More details for a wide range of vehicles local to you, visit vwfs.ie/business. So until the next time, thank you for being with us.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.